Ezekiel chapter 17, and we are going to try to get through two different chapters tonight, but not two consecutive chapters. On Sunday, we covered Ezekiel chapter 18, fairly notable, well-known, important chapter in the book of Ezekiel. And tonight, we'll go back to chapter 17, which we hadn't got to yet, and then we will jump over 18 and try to get through 19 as well. And interestingly, I think there is at least the imagery that connects these two chapters, but maybe also some themes that we will tie together between these two chapters as well, Ezekiel 17 and 18. Sorry, 17 and 19. Okay, you're getting two handouts. One is just the normal handout for tonight for class number 17. And the other is a handout that actually you may have received before if you were in our Jeremiah class 2 years ago. And this handout runs through the last five kings of Judah, Josiah and his sons. Now, there's also a place on the top of the handout for tonight to fill these in. I realize that's somewhat redundant, and maybe you think that's too elementary to have one handout with all the answers and then the other handout where I'm just asking you to fill it in. Nobody hates anything more than busy work, so if you think that's what this is, then just don't fill it out. Rebel. Don't do the assignment. That's fine. But maybe filling these out and seeing it in a more geometrical fashion will help remember these kings, which is our first of three objectives, to recall those last four kings of Judah, and maybe also recall what happened to them, what their fate was, a little bit about the story. Chapter 17 is going to be a fable, a parable, a riddle about two eagles and a vine. And so by the end of class, hopefully you can remember that story, tell that story, and then explain what that story means, what it's all about. And then again, hopefully by the end, after getting through these two chapters, we can have a discussion about what this means for us and draw a lesson, at least one, from these final days of Judah and Jerusalem and their political situation and what that means for us and our relationship with God. Okay, so let's talk about the last five kings of Judah. Again, this is a review, but it's been a while, and these things are always hard to keep straight. So let's start with Josiah. You see his dates there. And what most important thing to remember about Josiah is that he is the last good king. Some may say he's the best king that Judah ever had, maybe apart from David. But Josiah is definitely the last of the good kings in the southern kingdom. But he makes this fatal mistake. It's one of the strangest stories in the Bible in 2 Kings 23, where, again, Josiah has had a very good track record to this point, particularly in the way that he has cleansed Judah and Jerusalem of idolatry and recommitted the people to keeping the law of the Lord. But there's all these political events, these world events going on around Jerusalem, around Judah. And one of those is that the Egyptians are traveling up through Palestine to meet up with the Assyrians to fight against the Babylonians. And so for whatever reason, Josiah feels like he needs to go out and stop Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his army from passing through Palestine. And Pharaoh even sends him word ahead of time to say, don't get involved. I'm not concerned with you. Just stay out of it. Josiah doesn't stay out of it. He goes to battle against Pharaoh Necho and is killed in 609 BC. Okay. Then the other kings that are much harder to remember. Josiah has a son named Jehoahaz, and he is put on the throne by the people. You see on your supplemental handout, which is something true of basically each of these, they have a different name before they're made king. So that's confusing. But Shalom is made king by the people named Jehoahaz, but he only lasts for 3 months. On Pharaoh's way back from the battle at Carchemish, he stops in Jerusalem and says, no, I don't like this guy too much. I don't like Jehoahaz, so he's not going to be king anymore. So Jehoahaz briefly reigns, is deposed and taken by Pharaoh to Egypt as a captive. And in Jehoahaz's place, another son of Josiah named Eliakim becomes Jehoiakim and becomes king, as you see there, for 10 years or so. Okay. Now, having been instated, put on the throne by Pharaoh, Jehoiakim has a secure spot. But during the interim, during the 10 years that he's reigning, Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar come to be the dominant world power. So Jehoiakim will submit kind of to Babylon, and it is in this time, around 605, that the first wave of captives, including Daniel and his friends, will go into captivity. But eventually, before Jehoiakim dies, he turns against Babylon. Having been submitted and agreed to kind of, you know, surrender, so to speak, to Babylon's power, Nebuchadnezzar's power, he rebels, tries to turn against Babylon, but he dies of natural causes, and his son, Jeconiah, or Coniah, or Jehoiachin, as he's named when he becomes king, reigns in his place. Now, this name is maybe more familiar to us in our study of Ezekiel, because he is the king who is on the throne when Nebuchadnezzar shows up to basically capture the city of Jerusalem and take that second wave of captives to Babylon. Remember that captivity in 598, 597, not only includes the king himself, so Jehoiachin is taken to Babylon as a captive, but also who else is a part of this captivity? Well, it's on your sheet, but Ezekiel is a part of this captivity, 598, 597, taken away. And so with Jehoiachin off the throne, somebody has to be put on the throne, and Nebuchadnezzar will see to it that Mattaniah, also named Zedekiah, will reign in Jehoiachin's place. But remember, Zedekiah is not a son of Jehoiachin. He is an uncle of Jehoiachin, or another son of Josiah. And as we will see, Zedekiah, put on the throne by Babylon, will also not stay loyal to Babylon, but will after a while rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, bringing on the final wrath of Nebuchadnezzar, and leading to the destruction, total destruction of Jerusalem in 586, when the rest of the people are taken to captivity, including Zedekiah, who sees his sons killed, has his eyes plucked out, and dies in Babylon, as we've talked about before. Okay, so little review of the final days of Jerusalem, of the kings of Judah. Again, you see at the top of that supplemental worksheet, 2 Kings 23 and 24 is where you can go read about all of that, see that in more detail. Okay, any questions? I know this is like the prime discussion topic here. Everyone is just chomping at the bit to know more and to talk more about Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Jehoahaz. But any questions that can clear anything up, anything you're not sure about? Clear as mud. Okay, you'll see in a minute why we're taking the time to go through all this, because it will be relevant to the text of Ezekiel 17 and 19 as well. But let's read Ezekiel 17. Ezekiel 17, the heading probably says that it's a parable. Verse 2 says it's a parable and a riddle. And so similar to other places in the Bible where there are parables told, we're going to read the parable itself, and maybe it will make some sense, maybe it will make zero sense, but there will be an explanation, thankfully, to the parable given after the telling of the parable. So we'll just go ahead and read it all together. All of chapter 17, this parable of the two eagles and the vine. Ezekiel 17 and verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel, saying, Thus says the Lord God, a great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and a full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon and took away the top of the cedar. He plucked off the topmost of its young twigs and brought it to a land of merchants. He set it in a city of traders. He also took some of the seed of the land and planted it in the fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it like a willow. Then it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine, with its branches turned toward him, but its roots remained under it. So it became a vine and yielded shoots and sent out branches. Verse 7, but there was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage. And behold, this vine bent its roots toward him and sent out its branches toward him from the beds where it was planted, that he might water it. It was planted in good soil beside abundant waters, that it might yield branches and bear fruit and become a splendid vine. Say, thus says the Lord God, will it thrive? Will he not pull up its roots and cut off its fruit so that it withers, so that its sprouting leaves wither? And neither by great strength nor by many people can it be raised from its roots again? Behold, though it was planted, will it thrive? Will it not completely wither as soon as the east wind strikes it? Wither on the beds where it grew? Verse 11, Ezekiel 17. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, say now to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Say, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem, took its king and princes, and brought them to him in Babylon. He took one of the royal family and made a covenant with him, putting him under oath. He also took away the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be in subjection, not exalting itself, but keeping his covenant that it might continue. But he rebelled against him by sending envoys to Egypt, that they might give him horses and many troops. Will he succeed? Will he who does such things escape? Can he indeed break the covenant and escape? As I live, declares the Lord God, surely in the country of the king who put him on the throne, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he broke, in Babylon he shall die. Pharaoh with his great army and great company will not help him in the war when they cast up ramps and build siege walls to cut off many lives. Now he despised the oath by breaking the covenant. And behold, he pledged his allegiance, yet did all these things. He shall not escape. Verse 19, therefore thus says the Lord God, as I live, surely my oath which he despised and my covenant which he broke, I will inflict on his head. I will spread my net over him, and he will be caught in my snare. Then I will bring him to Babylon and enter into judgment with him there regarding the unfaithful act which he has committed against me. All the choice men and all his troops will fall by the sword, and the survivors will be scattered to every wind, and you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken. Verse 22, thus says the Lord God, I will also take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar and set it out. I will pluck from the topmost of its young twigs a tender one, and I will plant it on a high and lofty mountain. On the high mountain of Israel I will plant it, that it may bring forth boughs and bear fruit and become a stately cedar. And birds of every kind will nest under it. They will nest in the shade of its branches. All the trees of the field will know that I am the Lord. I bring down the high tree, exalt the low tree, dry up the green tree, and make the dry tree flourish. I am the Lord, I have spoken, I will perform it. Okay, let's go through here, break this up into four sections, starting with first the story itself, and then we'll talk about the history that provides us with the interpretation. So, this is called in verse 2, a parable and a riddle. This may not be anything. Could just be that these are two ways of saying the same thing. But it is a little bit curious, because is there a difference between a parable and a riddle? What do you think? Michael's giving me a strong affirmative head nod. What would be the difference, do you think, between a parable and a riddle? You don't think there's a difference? So a parable will teach a lesson, right? And in some ways, we might say that the parable is intended to highlight the lesson, right? Maybe make it more clear. What about a riddle? What?
Can teach a lesson, but doesn't have to.
Doesn't have to. What's kind of the point of a riddle? Yeah, it's almost like to stump is what Beth said, to stump you, or to cover up what the true meaning is, right? So obligatory, not Lord of the Rings, but Hobbit reference, right? Bilbo's riddle to Gollum, the whole point of that is to not allow Gollum to know what the answer is, okay? So as we go through, it would be interesting to think, okay, what about this as a parable intended to teach an obvious lesson, okay? And maybe are there things about this that are intended to be a riddle, kept secret or kept unknown, maybe at least for the time being. I don't know. Again, maybe we're making too much of that. But let's talk about the story. You could also think of this as a fable. There are fables in the Bible, you know, where plants or animals are personified in a certain way, like we're familiar with in fables, again, to teach a lesson. But what happens here? There's a great eagle. What does the great eagle do? First, he plucks the top of a cedar from where? Lebanon. Geographically, where is Lebanon? Just north of Israel, okay? And what do we know about cedars in Lebanon? They're desirable, they're great, okay? And where does he take the eagle? He plucks that top twig off the cedar, and where does he take it? City of merchants, so we can come back to that, but the land of merchants, and then he has something else. I think these are two different things. First, he takes the twig and puts it in the land of the merchants, and then he does something else, and what is that? He plants a seed. Where does he plant the seed? I think this is something different. So he takes a seed, maybe a seed from that same tree, from that same forest, you might say, puts it in a fertile field, puts it by abundant waters, right? What's the intent of doing that? Yeah, he wants it to grow, he wants it to flourish, he wants it to succeed. And what happens to that seed that is planted in this very nice spot? Yeah, it grows and it spreads, okay? Now, it's just a vine, it doesn't become a lofty cedar, okay? But still, it grows and it spreads, and the branches, it says, are reaching out toward that eagle, okay? So rooted in its place, reaching out towards the eagle. But then another eagle comes along, it says in verse 7. And what happens when that other eagle comes along? Changes its allegiance. Thank you, Robert. It starts reaching out towards that eagle instead. And so the kind of moral of the story, the obvious conclusion is what? The question is asked, is that vine going to prosper? No. Okay. A little bit concerned there. Okay. The conclusion given is no, it will not prosper. Instead, it will be uprooted. It will be cut off and it will wither completely. Now, I don't know. I ask you what you think. This disloyal vine reaching out to the other eagle, eagle number two, we might say. It says in verse 9, will he not pull up its roots, cut off its fruit so that it withers? Who do you think the he is? Who's uprooting the vine? Is it eagle number one uprooting the vine in basically vengeance? Or is it eagle number two uprooting the vine, trying to move it, transport it, help it, but in the end that really makes it worse? What do you think? Dan says he thinks it's eagle number two. Robert says door number one, eagle number one. So, we'll let Dan and Robert go at it later on. I'm not sure. It's a little bit ambiguous. Maybe from the interpretation we can come to a better conclusion. But either way, the point is, when that disloyal vine stretches out to the other eagle, it's going to end up being uprooted, eventually cut off. You can't replant it, and it will wither completely. Okay? Now, I will say this, maybe I should have done this, but I'll ask you this. If you only had this parable with no interpretation whatsoever, it was just this and then it was over, what do you think we would maybe assume is the analogy being made here, or the comparisons being made here? Who would be who in the stories, you think? If, again, there was no interpretation given to us, we're just on our own to kind of guess. God's the eagle, right? Who's the vine? Yeah, Israel's the vine, and then who's the other eagle? I don't know, yeah, the idols or somebody, other nations maybe. That's kind of the natural reading of this, if you read it. In fact, we'll maybe mention this. There are other passages like Isaiah chapter 5, where it talks about Israel like a vineyard that God planted and really expected to bear fruit, but it didn't. It turned out sour grapes, okay? And so it has similarities to other passages like that, perhaps. But as it happens, we get to verse 11, and that's actually not the interpretation given, at least at first. Let's talk about what the interpretation historically is in verses 11 to 18. Who's the first eagle? Babylon, Robert said. I thought I heard him from here. Okay. And so this is why we went over this history here. It says that the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and took its kings and its princes, verse 12, and brought them to Babylon. Do you remember? You can look back at your handout. It's okay. Which king in Jerusalem was taken by the king of Babylon to Babylon? Jehoiachin, okay? The one right there in the middle under Josiah on your chart, okay? By the way, we talked about the land of merchants. In the infamous Ezekiel 16, verse 29, it says, talks about, you know, Israel or Jerusalem playing the harlot with these other nations, and it talks about the land of merchants that is Chaldea. Chaldea is the same as Babylonia, right, where Babylon is. And so we know from the fable that that's where that is. And so the eagle that takes the sprig to Babylon is a picture of Jehoiachin being uprooted out of Jerusalem and taken to Babylonia, okay? And then it talks about, in verse 13, the king of Babylon taking one of the royal family and making a covenant with him, putting him under oath. And remember, who was the one of the royal family that the king of Babylon made this agreement with after he's deposed Jehoiachin? By the way, I think I told you wrong. Jehoiachin on your chart should be like two down from Josiah. Sorry, Kim. She's looking at me like, I knew you were wrong. I just knew it. I didn't want to say anything. So Jehoiachin, and then who's put on the throne by the king of Babylon? Zedekiah. Okay, that's the seed that's planted and placed in Jerusalem. Now, we can fill in, now that we know the historical figures, we can fill in a little bit from the parable. Remember that the parable said that the eagle planted this seed by fertile field and abundant waters. How would that translate to the situation between the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and Zedekiah?
They were told to go with them and plan to live a while, weren't they?
I see. Yeah, so God would tell the exiles, yeah, you know, seek your own welfare, the welfare of Babylon, move there. I think that'll be related. But remember, Zedekiah is still in Jerusalem, and the king of Babylon's put him there. So what do we make of all this, you know, fertile field, abundant waters? Robert, you got to...
Any chance it's Ezekiel 1:1, where Ezekiel is by the river Chebar in Babylon?
Well, again, in the story here, the seed that's planted is Zedekiah, who is still in Jerusalem, right? I guess I would ask it this way. What does it perhaps tell us about Nebuchadnezzar's desire initially? What did you say, Robert? Yeah, I think the point is that Nebuchadnezzar, and this is basically true of all people that rule over great empires, at least Nebuchadnezzar, he wanted Zedekiah and Jerusalem to be a, you know, operating, healthy part of his larger empire, okay? Nebuchadnezzar wasn't into just on a whim going in and destroying cities just for the fun of it, okay? There was a sense of, we have an agreement here, okay? You're serving as king in Jerusalem. There's no mistake who's in charge here, but you do your thing, and I hope it all works out, and you flourish as a, you know, outlying region of the larger Babylonian empire. Does that make sense? Okay, that's perhaps what Nebuchadnezzar wants, but again, following the parable and going off of the interpretation given in verse 15, what does Zedekiah do instead? He goes to Egypt. Remember from our earlier stories, Egypt is always basically opposed to Babylon in this story. They're the big power to the south of Israel and Judah, while Babylon to the north, to the east, is the big power. So Egypt is sitting there, as always is, a seductive option for Jerusalem and for Judah to say, well, maybe Egypt can help us out. That's exactly what Zedekiah does. He goes to Egypt for help. And again, as the fable ended, the historical interpretation concludes with a question, okay? Verse 15, will he succeed? Is it going to work out for Zedekiah to go to Egypt and get help against Babylon? No, okay, there we go. Almost got concerned again. He will die in Babylon. He'll be removed. It's not going to work out. Pharaoh won't be able to help because, verse 18, he despised the oath by breaking the covenant, told Nebuchadnezzar, yeah, I'll serve you, yeah, this can work out great, but in the end, he rebels, tries to make an alliance with Egypt, and it won't work out well for him. Okay, questions up to this point. Patty? The second eagle is Egypt, yes. Thank you for asking that. Eagle number two is Egypt. So eagle number one, Babylon. The vine is maybe very specifically Zedekiah, maybe more generally it's just Jerusalem, okay, the people in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is planted, more or less, by Babylon. Babylon is ruling over them, wants them to do well, but Zedekiah and Jerusalem turn their branches, reaching out to Egypt for help, and that will be their undoing, okay? Questions on that? Questions on that historical interpretation? Yes, Rob.
And is in verse 10, is the east wind Babylon? The vine withers because Babylon's going
to
wipe them out.
That's a good connection. Remember, east is from Judah is Babylon from the east, although they always have to come from the north. So oftentimes the judgment's from the north because the road goes, you know, over and around. But yes, Babylon comes through. Now, remember back to our question. Was basically like, who uproots the vine? Is it eagle number one or eagle number two? I think actually you could make a case for either one in the interpretation. To Robert's point, it's clearly Babylon kind of comes through and says, you betrayed the oath we made, we're taking you out. But you could also see in the language about Pharaoh won't be able to help you, kind of the idea of, well, that second eagle may uproot you to try to bring you to safer ground, but that's actually going to hurt you more than it helps you. Okay, that's always what happens when God's people turn to Egypt, this seductive help, like Hagar the Egyptian or Lot going to the land that looks like the land of Egypt. Egypt always means a seductive option for help that turns out way worse for the people of God if they trust in it instead of trusting in God. Okay, so the same thing happens here. Okay, now let's make a turn here. Because in verse 19 through 21, an interesting thing happens. God starts talking about this. Remember, this was like Zedekiah made an agreement with Nebuchadnezzar, broke the agreement, turned to Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar's not happy about it. But God in verse 19 to 21 starts using very personal language. He says, verse 19, my oath, my covenant, which he broke, I will inflict this on his head. He'll be caught in my snare, verse 20. I will bring him to Babylon, enter into judgment. Maybe most clearly, verse 19, he committed this unfaithful act against me. So my question to you would be, and I want to hear what you have to say, why is this whole political maneuvering here by Zedekiah, why is it so personal to God? Why does he say, you committed this against me, and I will judge you for it? So Dan says it's because what Zedekiah is doing is not relying on God, but relying on Egypt for help. Thank you, Dan. Other ideas? Because I think there are probably multiple answers here. Why does God take it so personally? Michael?
Maybe it has something to do with, Jeremiah told him what was going to happen, you know, and like he was still like trying to like make it not happen. You know, and totally going about it the wrong way, as Dan was saying, you know, instead of turning to God, you know, he's turning to Egypt.
So not only is it not trusting in God, it's not listening to the very words of God's prophets who kept telling them, don't do this. It's, you know, this is what's going to happen. Just submit to God's will. Thank you, Michael. Ian, you're gearing up to...
I was just going to say, you know, they're breaking a lot of fundamental covenants God made with them and things God told them not to do here and just slapping them in the face. You know, God is going to provide to them in every way, and they're leaning on themselves and the relationships that they formulate with other superpowers to make themselves better instead of trusting God to do that.
Thank you, Ian. Breaking fundamental covenants is what Ian says. And Robert, maybe one more thought on this?
I think it's exactly the same corollary as you see in 1 Samuel 8 when Samuel's crying out to God, why are these people demanding a king and they rejecting me as a judge? And God's like, they didn't reject you, they rejected me.
So great connection, I think, to 1 Samuel 8, because it shows us that, so remember, that's the very beginning. That's the alpha of the monarchy in Israel, Saul, and the asking for a king and Saul. Now we're at the omega. We're at Zedekiah, the final king being, you know, displaced. And what Robert, that connection shows us is that literally from beginning to end, they were trusting in the wrong thing. They thought if we have a king, then we'll be okay because we'll be like all the other nations. We'll have a big, strong guy like Saul, you know. And then even still here at the end, they're trusting in political alliances. They're trusting in the monarchy, right, to bail them out as opposed to in both Samuel and Ezekiel, Jeremiah at the end, trusting in God to be their king, to rule over them, and to submit to his will. Okay, so I think it's all there. Okay, so here's what I would say. These are the three levels I would give you. On one hand, there's maybe just a principle about sin here, right? You could probably call to mind other Bible passages, right, where like Joseph is asked to commit adultery with Potiphar's wife, and he says, "I can't do this thing and sin against God," right? All sin is sin against God. So in here, this breaking of an oath, lying, deceit, betrayal, all betrayal is a betrayal against God. On another level, I gave you a reference here to 2 Chronicles 36. In the account of the treaty that Zedekiah made with Nebuchadnezzar, it says that Zedekiah swore, it means took an oath, by God, right? So he swore, Jehovah, hold me accountable to this oath, right? And we know how God feels about, you know, the seriousness of oaths, especially when he is the collateral, so to speak. So that heightens the sense of the breaking of the oath here. But I think as the comments have done an excellent job of pointing out, there really is something deeper going on here. And maybe you noticed some of the connections, and maybe all along, even as we were given the historical interpretation of the parable, you were still a little bit uneasy, thinking, but yeah, there seems to be something more going on here, okay? So for instance, we've already talked about the connection to Isaiah 5, other passages where Israel is the vine and God is the one who wants them to flourish. Maybe you picked up on Ezekiel 17, verse 12, say now to this rebellious house, okay? Remember that from Ezekiel chapter 2, how many times God said over and over again, they're a rebellious house, and he meant rebellious against whom? Against him, against God, okay? And maybe, as I was trying my best to convince you that Nebuchadnezzar was just this loving, caring, benevolent king who wanted the best for his people, even in the way the parable's told, we might think, this still just doesn't quite fit. Yeah, I do think Nebuchadnezzar didn't want to destroy Jerusalem. He wanted generally things to work out well. But the language seems to go beyond that to say they're planted by a fertile field, abundant waters. I do think this is in a larger sense, it is a picture of God wanting his people to submit and to trust in him to take care of them, but they don't. They have betrayed him, they have rebelled against him and trusted in themselves and in alliances. And so this particular situation, maybe this is the main point here, this particular circumstance of betraying Nebuchadnezzar and going to Egypt is just, what's the word I'm looking for? A microcosm. It's one example of a much greater thing that they're always doing, which is rejecting, rebelling against God's care and provision to turn to other things to trust in. Does that make sense? And in some ways, that is confirmed by the conclusion of the chapter. Because the conclusion of the chapter says that there will be another sprig taken from the tree, and it will be planted, and it's going to flourish, and it's going to be a big tree, and all the birds of the earth will come and... What's that talking about, the last three verses of the chapter? What's that a picture of? A tree that's planted, it grows, birds come and take their refuge. The air is on, that's why I can't hear what you're saying. Yeah, it's about the restoration of God's people. And who's going to do that? Nebuchadnezzar? No, God's going to do that. Okay, and you can make several corollaries. But Isaiah 11 talks about the stem from the root of Jesse, okay, is going to sprout forth as the descendant of David comes to. So same tree, think about it that way. Same tree here. That Jehoiachin came from, that Zedekiah came from, same tree as Josiah, but it's going to be a sprig from that same tree, from the root of Jesse, and planted to be placed on a high mountain. Robert did this for you, Isaiah chapter 2, the mountain that's highest above all the other mountains of the earth, Zion, this new heavenly, or this new kingdom in the Messiah, and even the language of a tree that provides refuge to birds. This is the nations of the earth, the peoples of the earth finding refuge in God's kingdom. Oaks of righteousness from Isaiah 61 verse 3 when the Messiah comes. All of this is pointing to something greater. So that's the ultimate hope for God's people. And notice the ultimate hope for God's people is not in some kind of more advantageous political alliance. Their hope is not in another descendant of Josiah who's going to, like the other earthly kings they've had, bail them out finally. The hope is in what God's going to do in the Messiah in establishing of the Messianic kingdom. Albert?
That's where I was thinking the Messianic aspect. I was like, is it a stretch? But, when it talks about every kind of bird, there will be everybody, Jew, Gentile, be able to take protection underneath it.
Yeah, and I should have written it down, but you may remember that Jesus tells the parable of the mustard seed, keep this passage in mind when we read the parable of the mustard seed, because the mustard seed grows into a big tree, and Jesus says it provides shade and it provides a nest for birds, to come and, make their home and everything. He's coming back to Ezekiel 17 here in this picture of the kingdom, and as Albert points out, all the various creatures that find their refuge is the Jew, Gentile, every tribe, tongue, language, nation kind of thing. Then they will know that I am the Lord, and I have spoken, and I will perform it. Okay? And now we're caught. Not time enough with the first bell just rung to do chapter 19. So let's do this. Let me just zip here to the end. And so we obviously didn't talk about chapter 19, so the question should read, what does this chapter, chapter 17, let's talk about this. What does this mean for us? What would Ezekiel 17 teach us in our modern context as Christians about the way that we view nations of the earth the way that we view the rulers of the earth, maybe even the way that we view political events in our world. What would you say we should learn from Ezekiel 17? They're very temporary. The nations are temporary. The rulers are temporary. What do you mean? Oh, all the above, right?
Yeah, all the above.
Don't sweat it. So everything's temporary, Victoria says. Patty piggybacks here. Don't sweat it. God's in charge. Okay? Other things you would say. Ian, were you? You were like doing this. Ian and Michael.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, our only hope or allegiance should be in God. It should not be to any given nation or person or idol. It should be to God.
Okay. Thank you. Michael?
I was reminded with all the talk of Zedekiah and his rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar taking over Jerusalem was part of God's judgment, wasn't it? And I mean, they knew it. It was revealed to them by the prophets. And so, I mean, he knew that it was God doing that, and he was rebelling against the ruler God put in place. But it reminded me of what we read in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians, just that we're supposed to be obedient to the authorities God puts in place.
Is that a Robert, a hand, or just a thumbs up?
And just to build on that, Romans 13, all governments come from God. And then the other one that I was reminded of was when the three of us talked to, or taught Matthew 23, the woe to the Pharisees and scribes. And they kept putting their trust in the temple and the gold of the temple. And you know, verse 21 says, "He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it." And again, the whole point of all that is God makes the temple important at the time. So it's all about God. It's not about us or the nations around us or the nation that we're in, which is the same exact thing that we just got through reading with the.
Sure, yeah. And a nice connection there to the making of oaths. You know, maybe I'm trying to put it all together. We now are the temple of God. God dwells in us. So the making of an oath is just your yes is your yes and your no is your no.
I was just thinking about where I go or where we go when we're in trouble. Are we looking for a physical out, like something I can do or someone I can get to help me? Or are we first reaching out to God and letting him supply what we need as opposed to trying to fix it and solve it ourselves?
A lot of good stuff here. And in my mind, one common thread here that I hear everybody saying is that, how to say this exactly, we have a tendency to first, I think, separate the kind of events of our physical life and even political events, separate that from God's, the kind of realm that, you know, God's a part of. And so on one hand, what we're saying is that then when we do that, we want to trust in the external thing. We want to trust in, as Ian said, our efforts, something that there's got to be a way for me to manipulate the situation to change it for my good. Or we trust in the things that we can see, like nations. Okay, well, you know, we're the United States of America. We'll do X, Y, Z. We'll figure it out. Or if only my people that I like could be in charge and be in office, we could all vote all the right people in, then we'll fix all the problems. So you see, it's this trust in the externals, trust in nations or people or ourselves. Okay? But the point is we trust in God and what he's doing, and we don't separate the two. So anything in the world of politics is not somehow separate from our responsibility to God. Anything we do in business when we make agreements or contracts is not somehow separate. We can say, oh, well, it's just business, so I can go back on my word. Or it's just politics, so I can, you know, this person's fine for breaking their word or doing X, Y, Z. No, God, if God's in control of all of it, then not only do we trust in him, but we stay loyal and faithful to him regardless of the context, regardless of the situation, because we've said all these other things are temporary, but our covenant with the Lord is forever. So, okay. Well, you can go back and read chapter 19 and maybe even use the worksheet to try to figure it out for yourself. I don't know how much time we'll spend on chapter 19 on Sunday, but we'll go forward, 19, 20, and beyond. Thank you, guys.